This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney, and joining us to discuss the stories affecting the tri-state this week are Cincinnati Business Courier staff reporter and columnist Chris Wederick, WCPO.com, WCPO Insider Transportation and Development reporter Pat LaFleur, and WVXU City Hall reporter Jay Hanselman. You can be part of the conversation, 513-419-7100. You can email talk at WVXU.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Jay, Chris, and Pat, thanks for joining us this afternoon.
Thanks for having me.
Good afternoon.
Yeah, the streetcar got underway. It was that first full week of operation for it. So how'd that first week go?
Very smooth, I guess the important
swimmingly
thing. There were no accidents. That was a good thing. I think there have been hiccups, but look, anytime you have something new, I think there are going to be hiccups. And, you know, for what could have gone wrong, I think everybody is kind of breathing a sigh of relief that there's not been any more major problems than there already have been. And what have been are problems with, like, the ticket vending machines.
It's mainly been technological issues, right?
The counters on the actual streetcars, and I still am not sure that the tracking, the online tracking, is working.
That's not up and running yet, no.
Correctly, but it could have been much worse.
They actually do have the website version of the online tracking shows you the position of each streetcar, and I think they have it working today.
On a desktop?
Yeah, platform. On the desktop. So if you're sitting in your office and you're...
But I'm not sure about that because tell us how busy I am today that I've been watching this thing on my desktop. But I thought between 11 a.m. and 7 p.m. there were supposed to be three streetcars out, and I can only find two.
I noticed that one was missing, but then I clicked on one of the stops, and it said it's coming in 5 minutes, and I didn't see one that was necessarily
a Pokemon
coming in five. Right, it's a Pokemon streetcar.
Well, location services are always tricky. You know, it's all satellite-based, and... It's a good tool to have, but when it's not working exactly right, it's not the biggest issue.
That's super. It can be super frustrating. I mean, I think just in this day and age, people want the technology to work and to tell them exactly when, you know, when the next streetcar is coming, and they have a limited amount of time. One of the interesting things that SORTA did put out, I mean, I think with each one of these ridership numbers they put out, there's kind of been a deep breath because you've had the naysayers say all along, nobody's going to ride this thing. It's just it's a boondoggle, and no one wants to get on it. During the first 3 days of service where it was free, they had over 50,000 riders, or at least that was the estimate based upon the data that they were able to collect. They had a little bit of problems with the data collection software. And then SORTA being the Southwest Ohio Regional Transit Authority, the agency that runs Metro and operates the streetcar on a day-to-day basis, they announced today that they had more than 3,100 riders a day on average over the first four days.
I believe it was 12,740 total Monday through Thursday.
And it was, I think, an average of 3,185. I wonder, you know, I don't know what you think, Jay or Pat, but you know, I wonder if they would kind of hope that was a little bit higher given the newness of it, but...
I was a little bit shocked because I was expecting it to be higher.
Yeah.
Because I rode, and I've been trying now, yesterday and today I was going to ride again, and so far that hasn't happened. But I rode Wednesday, and it was packed.
Yeah.
And
did you ride at lunchtime?
It was around 11 o'clock.
Yeah.
And but what surprised me, and that's why I thought the number would be higher, it was a lot of... It's like a kid at Christmas. It's new, and you've got your new toys that you want to play with, and then, you know, after the newness wears off, those toys aren't as fun as they were on Christmas morning. But there were a lot of people. I met somebody had their family on from Germany.
Yeah.
There were some people from Texas. And I was just kind of surprised with the newness that the number was a little bit higher. And it almost makes me wonder when the newness wears off, what's going to happen to that daily average, considering they're just a little bit above what they projected early on.
One thing to keep in mind when it comes to ridership numbers, too, is that as far as the operational budget for the first year is concerned, out of the 4 million and some change, only about 300,000 of that is expected to come from fare revenue. The highest portion is from parking meters. While ridership is huge, and SORTA CEO today said that the streetcar's success will be governed by ridership and by economic development.
Right.
At the same time, it is important to keep in mind that as far as funding it goes, it's actually a pretty small amount of where that money is coming from as far as fare is concerned.
I just feel like psychologically,
absolutely,
they need to have, you know, for the city to feel good about it and for to, you know, for it to feel that it was worth building. You know, they need to hit that target.
And no one wants to see an empty streetcar.
Well, you know, and you know what, they're already photos on social media. Somebody took a photo at 10:30 at night. Guess what? There weren't that many people on the streetcar.
Yeah, but that's probably to be expected.
Yeah, that's probably.
I mean, if you look at any parking lot in the city, most of the cars are empty. You know, I mean, I'm not sure that's an empty streetcar anecdotally is even all that compelling an anecdote.
Well, and another point that Dwight brought up today was that as they collect data on, and you asked this question.
You're talking Dwight Farrell, who's
the CEO of a Metro and the Transit Authority. Chris, you asked him, when are people riding? Can you get a sense for what time of day? They don't have that data yet, he said, but as they study that, they can adjust the headways and the hours and kind of focus on those peaks a little more.
Yeah, I mean, when I've ridden around lunch most of the days this week, and it has been packed. You know, the other interesting thing about it is, you know, I rode up to Findlay Market one day, and I would say maybe a third of the people on the streetcar got off at Findlay Market.
That's what I was going to say. The stop that I was on, it was like I started at Music Hall, and of course, from there around to the, I guess it would be the Elm Street side.
Yeah.
The Ray Street side,
right,
of Findlay Market. There was a lot of people piled off on the trip that I was on there.
We always thought that this would be kind of an advantage for Findlay Market, but I think it's going to be a big boon for them. I think it's going to change it altogether.
When the whole debate was going on, I think a lot of the supporters were folks involved with Findlay Market.
Yeah. Because you can, you know, I mean, I guess I timed my trip to Findlay Market. It took a little bit longer than I wanted it to. It took about 20 minutes. And, you know, but you can, you know, you can kind of get up there and back to work if you're down in the Central Business District. You can probably do it in a little bit over an hour. Ideally, I think you'd want to be able to do it in 1 hour. But, you know, I think you're going to see a lot of development start to pop up around Findlay Market. There was already stuff happening, but I think they're going to make a beeline to the Findlay Market area and look at things that they can do there.
And I think there's a learning curve, too, that's like I felt like a dunce. Because I've stopped at – when I got to Music Hall Wednesday to get on, it had just gone by, and the light bulb didn't click. Well, if you had just walked across Washington Park, you could have got on the stop on the other side,
right,
of Washington Park. But I didn't think about that until I rode by it a half an hour later. It's like, that was simple. And I was a little surprised, too. I think last weekend they had volunteers out trying to help people, and I think they're going to be out this weekend too,
because right,
there's going to be a huge crowd probably with Oktoberfest. But there were several people that didn't totally understand the process. I know there were four people that got on with me at the Music Hall stop, and this is a problem they're having system-wide. They didn't know about validating their ticket.
Right.
So I helped them validate their tickets. And
that's
then,
one of the issues Dwight Farrell brought up, didn't he?
That's right, yeah. And Chris and I were at the stop with him this morning looking at the machines. And to break it down as simply as possible, you can buy a ticket, and it is time-based, right? So you could buy a ticket and then just not hop on the streetcar for another week.
Right.
So that's why that second validation step is in there, so it can put a timestamp on your pass. And that's kind of what dictates when you can get on and for how long.
And does that work with – I know that works with the hourly. Does that work with the day pass too, that you can buy those in advance and then it doesn't – you still have to validate the day pass, but it doesn't start until the day you validate it. I'm assuming that's the same.
I think that's right. I bought the $10 all-you-can-ride for the first week one, so I haven't really had to – I used the app one day just to see if it worked.
I've only used the app, and the validation isn't even a part of using the app. So, you know, there is some – navigating of rules to get through in order to.
So people are thinking maybe the operator validates the ticket, but that's.
You can't even get to the operator.
Not the case at all.
It's a fare inspector. That's what the title of that.
But he's checking for validation, right?
Right.
Right.
Okay.
Some other people that jumped on at the Central Parkway stop by the Kroger building, and they were looking for someone to take their ticket. And of course, there wasn't anybody. And then in the process of talking to them, I said, well, did you validate your ticket? And of course, she had this blank look on her face, and they had not validated. And so when she got to where she was going, I said, see that where it says validate here or validate now? I said, that's where you need to put your ticket. That's and right. Like I said, this weekend.
So everybody knows how to do this exactly. What do you do to validate?
You buy your ticket, and then right underneath, I think where it says pay or something at the bottom of the vending machine, it says validate here or something.
That's right.
The word validate is there in some form, and you just insert it in there. And then if you use the app, I think you have to click on that ticket, and there's a button on the phone where you do use now.
Use now. That's
and then right. That starts a timer. If you've only got like a two-hour pass, then it starts counting down how much time that you have remaining on that ticket.
I think it's kind of a silly process, frankly. I don't know that they needed to set it up in this way. I feel like I understand why they did it, so you can buy your streetcar pass and then use it one, days or whatever later. But I feel like most people who are riding, they're buying the thing and they're going to get right on. So I feel like they could probably eliminate that step, and I don't think anybody would be unhappy.
Although it could be advantageous with this weekend being busy. If you had extra time today and you knew that you were going to ride tomorrow or Sunday, you could go ahead and buy your ticket today.
Yeah.
And then all you have to do is just validate it when you get to the stop. Tomorrow or Sunday. And the same thing on your phone.
I think Chris is probably onto something, though, as far as people are probably just going to hop on.
Yeah.
And the fact that they have those kiosks right there, I think, is kind of meant for that. So it does kind
now
of
Now, we do know, though,
step.
When they start enforcing it, it's going to be rather – you can either pay a dollar or you can gamble.
It's a $100 fine.
$99.
Yeah. And then it's $200 for every subsequent
If you
fence.
Get caught yeah. without – If you get caught without paying it, it is a $100 fine. I think it goes all the way up to, what, $300?
I think it just stays at $200, but at least that's what I heard at last check with the city. But
it's not cheap.
No.
And you just know the first person that has to cough up that $99, their face is going to be on the front page of the Inquirer that day. Look what they did to
not
me.
Not the Business Journal?
I don't know that we'll care all that much. But one of the other problems they've had is they're not really making it, like during the weekday, the streetcars are supposed to come every 12 minutes, and during the weekend and the other times they're supposed to come every 15. I got a story that's going to publish later today about that. I actually went out and timed some of the stoplights, and really the streetcar lanes are kind of at a disadvantage. The stoplights going east to west streets, they are shorter than the stoplights going north and south. So the city and SWORD are taking a look at that, and the city is going to do a study that they hope to be done by the end of the year and then implement the changes so that traffic flow can, be a little bit more adjusted around the streetcar route so that the streetcar can make those 12 to 15-minute headways. I know that's an issue that they have and are a little bit worried about because – people want to get on, and it's designed to come very frequently. Otherwise, people won't use it, and so they need to get it down to those goals.
And something thing. Brought up today was Dwight Farrell, again, the CEO of SWORD, brought up today how easy it is for a streetcar to get blocked.
Right.
And, it's kind of a double-edged sword with the way that this produces economic development along the route, because then you've got construction all along the route, too, so that chokes traffic patterns. So It's a lot of moving parts that can impact these headways pretty quickly. And someone, even if they're not parked in the streetcar lane, they could be parked they could just be really bad at parallel parking and
double parked.
Have a wheel out on the rack or on the track, sorry.
We will continue our weekly review of local news, and you can join us at 513-419-7100. Thanks to Beth Daniel for listening to 91.7 WVXU today. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Caney. Joining us to discuss the stories affecting the tri-state this week are Cincinnati Business Courier staff reporter and columnist Chris Wederick, WCPO.com, WCPO Insider, transportation and development reporter Pat LaFleur, and WVXU City Hall reporter Jay Hanselman. You can join the conversation at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Jay, we haven't decided exactly what this was. Was it a kerfuffle, a tiff, a debate, a dispute?
A row.
Yeah.
The British would call it a row.
Over the whole notion that the city and SWORD had a a debate or whatever you want to call it going on over about running the streetcars during Oktoberfest. What was that all about?
I think everyone universally agreed that typically on a weekend there will be two streetcars on the route with these 15-minute head-ins.
It was part of the contract,
right,
wasn't it?
Right. So basically, you know, every 15 minutes there will be, in theory, a streetcar arriving at a stop. Like I said, universally, everyone agreed that with the crowds expected downtown this weekend and two streetcars, that wasn't going to happen. So everyone seemed to agree that they needed additional service. The catch comes as to who's going to pay for that, or does it even need to be paid for? The city's argument is that the Omega, and I'm not going to try to tell you what that stands for, but essentially that's the agreement between the city and SORTA to manage the – to operate the streetcar, and then – SORTA has subcontracted out the operation to Transdev. They claim that they are only obligated to run two streetcars, and if the city wants to run any extra streetcars, that's considered a special event, and they have to pay for that. The city's argument is, no, you told us that you would provide these 15-minute headways, and if that takes more than two cars on a busy weekend, then you need to provide it. Basically, any decision on that was punted. The advertising vehicles, which sold the advertising and naming rights for the streetcar under a contract with SORTA, basically stepped up and said, look, if the money that's left over from the grand opening weekend, which I think was $7,000 or $8,000, and if the increased, you know, ridership doesn't create enough income through fares, if there's a shortfall, advertising vehicles is going to make up the difference. Going forward, at some point, worst case, I guess this is going to end up in the court.
Because what happens next time there's a big event?
Right. Both sides claim they're right. And normally when both sides claim they're right, it's up to a judge to say which one is.
Well, the contract states both of those things, too. What they're saying, the contract says – no one's lying about what the contract says.
Yeah. But it's which one is – which one's correct.
What's the correct interpretation, maybe?
Right.
Okay.
You know, Mayor John Cranley says that, you know, the part that SORTA is referring to, the special event part, he's saying that what we meant by that was if we have a time where we want to do better than 15 minutes and we want extra streetcars on the track in order to make that happen, that's when we have to pay. And so, you know, I think they got to, you know, they can't let this end up being a, you know, a public food fight. I think they need to really sit down and hammer it out. And it's just difficult because, you know, that, you know, how do you cover the costs, you know? It, you know, if there is one, if the fares don't cover it, this will be a good experiment this week to see whether if you have a high ridership event like Oktoberfest, whether the additional riders do cover the cost. If you have ridership, you have 50,000 people riding it like you did opening weekend, and then people actually have to pay for it. You know, you could easily cover the $20,000 cost. It seems to me that is going to be incurred here.
And so at least for Oktoberfest weekend, this is resolved.
Yeah, they're going to have at least four cars out. I think the most that they ever planned to run was four cars. They have five streetcars, but the fifth one is sort of a backup if something happens to one of the four that are out on the route. And part of this kerfuffle, if that's what we're going to call it, we didn't really anticipate.
What was the British word?
Row.
We really didn't anticipate because, you know, all the thinking all along until the summer was that the streetcar would actually be shut down during Oktoberfest because of its old location. It couldn't operate because basically the streetcar tracks go right through the middle of what was Oktoberfest. And then
it would just run an OTR instead because that's also an option.
And so then the chamber moved it.
To their
credit, and which actually is good because more people can, you know, parking wise with the Reds game, there's more parking options to the north, and they can ride the streetcar down to the ball game or to Oktoberfest.
513-419-7100. And Ed in College Hill joins us now. Hi, Ed.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good, thank you.
Thank you for taking my call. Excuse me. I lived in Hamburg, Germany, and also in Kassel in Hessen. And my experience with public transportation was extremely useful. For the 3 years that I lived in Hamburg, we didn't have a car. We didn't even need it. But, of course, that's a much thicker, you know, net of transportation. I find that the idea behind the streetcar here is very good because it's very reasonable to use. I hope that they are able to make a go of it. One should not expect that fares are going to carry the whole thing because it doesn't in Germany. But I find it's a really good thing. And, you know, I find to bring Cincinnati forward, you know, as a more progressive city. Secondly, I have two questions. One of them is, at what time would one, if there is a success with the streetcar, would they decide to take it up the hill to Clifton? And the second would be, what about peripheral parking so that people don't have to drive into downtown Cincinnati but could park at the periphery and take the streetcar in?
I think that the answer to the first question, at what point do they take it up the hill, that's going to be up to the city council and to the mayor. And one of the things that we've had a hard time as journalists is getting the city and the mayor to define what success is. And I think that that's an open question that we all need to ask again and again and again. And, you know, how long do you wait before you determine you have success? If they average 3,000 riders, their projection over the next 6 months, do we declare victory then? Or, you know, what time period is appropriate? And, you know, there are members of council. There's a majority of council, I think, today that would probably pursue at least starting the planning for going up the hill. But the fact of the matter is they need 6 votes in order to make that happen. So,
yeah, the mayoral seat's really important,
right?
6 votes, and where would the funding come from? I mean, that's probably one of the biggest questions.
Yeah, definitely, it's a huge question. You know, the city borrowed most of the money to do this, and it had the capacity to do so. So, you know, is there room to borrow any more to go up the hill?
Well, I think there's a couple.
The answer to that.
There's a couple of unknowns in all this too. I think a lot of it depends on the Obama administration has been very rail friendly.
Right.
One would assume that a Hillary Clinton administration would perhaps continue that. I'm assuming that most feel that a Trump administration would probably be not as friendly toward rail projects.
I disagree with that. I think that he said. And it was many, many months ago, and he's said all kinds of different things about
everything.
You know, he's had some contradictory things, but I think he didn't talk about streetcars, but he talked about high-speed rail, and he thought that our rail system in the United States is an embarrassment compared to the rest of the world. So I'm not sure that he would be as ideological on that as some other Republicans are.
The Midwest and Ohio specifically is markedly underserved as far as rail infrastructure goes. There's a huge gap running across the middle of the state.
And the other unknown is, you know, for the city's purposes, the mayoral race in 2017 could play a big factor in whether this goes uptown or not.
I know that John Schneider, one of the leading proponents of the streetcar, has not given up on Mayor Cranley and hopes that, you know, eventually he will be convinced that it's successful and that at least get some planning started on the second phase, even if it doesn't happen during the mayor's current or his, if assuming the mayor gets a second term, you know, at least having some planning go on during that. And if Councilwoman Simpson wins, I think that we can expect those discussions to move forward way more quickly than if Mayor Cranley is reelected.
And with 3 open council seats too, they could make Mayor Cranley's point mute if they get 6 streetcar advocates on council, and they already will have 4. If they all get
reelected,
they all get reelected, there would be 4. Yeah. They need 2 more, and you know, then they could pass things without the threat of a mayoral veto. And we also have to. I don't think that they're not going to give up on going to uptown, because even Milton Dehoney, the former city manager who launched this project, one of his comments were, you know, if we're only going to do the downtown loop, we ought not to be doing it. So there's expansion. It's just a matter of when, where, and how long.
Exactly. Well, most of the talk focuses on going farther north, going uptown. But I think there's some people in the south that would be highly interested. Northern Kentucky would be highly interested in.
And the one thing that I think has been quickly poo-pooed, at least from what I was told, was to build like a streetcar loop in uptown and then have a bus transport people between the downtown loop and the uptown loop. I don't think that's going to fly.
It adds a step that, again,
it slows.
I want to make this
down
as simple as possible for people, I think, is probably how this needs to be approached. Just so for the pure sake of not discouraging people, it takes someone getting frustrated one time and then they're done with it, especially in this city. So I think that was kind of shot down because not only does it kind of circumvent the whole idea of using rail in the first place, but it also adds that extra step.
I think they have a real problem with Uptown because of the Duke Energy case, which basically said the city has to foot the tab for.
And there's like a huge transmission line under Vine Street, as I recall.
I don't think they can go up Vine Street. I mean, I don't think that's been accepted yet by certain people, but I don't think they can go up Vine Street because they have a giant. And people forget there's more than Duke going under the streets. There's Cincinnati Bell. There's.
Well, they shouldn't mind, though.
Not right. Well, you're right. But there's Time Warner. There's other utilities. And if they decide to take the same tack that Duke did, the city's going to end up paying a whole heck of a lot for utilities. So I don't know. I think they need to find a different route.
What do you think of John Schneider's tunnel idea?
You know, I love that idea.
The tunnel idea.
Do you know about this?
No, I have not. What is this? Tell me.
Well, basically, John thinks that the city should look at digging a tunnel under
basically two short tunnels. Up at Christ and then going Christ Hospital and then going back under and emerging back up by UC, right?
His argument is that once you get past downtown, the service needs to speed up, and on the street it's very difficult to do that. And you know, basically he sees that as a gradual transition from an on-street streetcar to a light rail system. I don't know about the engineering on it. They need to do a lot more study about it. But it is an idea out there. And you know what? I mean, Schneider is an interesting character, right? Because he's responsible, or at least partly responsible, for three of the biggest projects in the city, which one would be Fort Washington Way being underneath and narrowed to connect downtown to the banks. The other being the wedge site for Great American Ballpark. And then the third, of course, is a streetcar. He contributed greatly to all of those ideas. So I don't ever count him out in terms of those ideas. But we've got a long way to go before we're digging a tunnel, that's for sure.
That's right.
513-419-7100. And Jeannie in downtown joins us. Hi, Jeannie.
Hi. I rode the streetcar Thursday, and I did the whole loop. And I thought it was great. I didn't like that ticket validation thing. I think if you buy a ticket for a day, then you should be prepared to use it that day with like the date on it or whatever. Versus if you're going to buy one for like 10 days or something, it should say on it like a 10-day ticket, and then maybe you validate it for the first day you do it, and then they know you can use it for 10 days from that date. But I thought that was a little kind of confusing. But other than that, I like the route. I would use it for going to the market and back instead of driving my car. And I thought that was great. It would save time. And by them coming frequently, I could go down there, maybe have lunch and buy a few things, come back, or go down there and shop a while, then come back. So I thought it was great. I hope it's a success.
And Jeannie, sounds like you plan to keep using the streetcar.
Oh, yeah, I would use it because I live on Walnut and Central Parkway. So when I look out my window, I can see the Central Parkway one. Or, like, if I want to go to the Finley Market, I could just walk to the one on Main Street and catch up to Finley Market. So I thought it was great.
Well, and thank you, Jeannie.
Yeah.
Okay, bye.
And that sort of use, I was just talking with John Schneider yesterday, and he was talking about how for this thing to succeed, it can't be something that only gets ridden by people who are visiting downtown. It has to be people using it for everyday purposes, like going to the market or grabbing lunch, etc. So that sort of account of the everyday aspect of the streetcar is going to be a really important element to this story going forward.
And for full disclosure here, Mark and I are going to ride it to lunch. We had made a joke or a bet three or four years ago, we weren't going to go to the banks for lunch until we could ride the streetcar.
That's right.
So we've been waiting three to four years to go to lunch.
You went on vacation the week it opened, so we couldn't do it then.
We'll have to do it next week.
So, yeah, we definitely have to do it next week, Jay. We have to keep putting this off. We have to stop putting this off, I should say. Yeah. Let's talk to John in Mount Auburn. Hi, John.
Good afternoon. My recollection going to Cleveland was that the subway ticket vending machine spit out a ticket complete stamped with the date.
What is it with the two-step thing, right?
Yeah, well, they also had a validation slot, but that was for media that you bought ahead of time. And the simple thing might be, well, it sounds simple, but the mechanics, is to set the display screen so that it defaults and basically says, you want to go right now? Or there's a button that you press for you want one for later or whatever that you'd have to validate. And that might save a lot of confusion because you'd have to take an extra step or two to get one that you're going to use later.
John, thank you for the call. And Pat, has Metro brought up the idea of changing this system, or are they pretty much committed to sticking with this?
Well, given this morning's news briefing downtown with the Transit Authority CEO, Dwight Farrell, he and several staffers were standing there with signs and T-shirts that said validate on them. So I'm not sure that they're
at
that
point
yet.
I don't think they're
thinking about it. Okay. I think right now they're in the mode of trying to educate. And, you know, that's been a running theme all along is learning curve, educating the public on how to use this. So I don't know if they're going to change it or not. They might. I mean, they're a flexible organization when it comes down to it. So, you know, and that they're using such state-of-the-art software and hardware suggests that if they wanted to change it, they probably could pretty easily.
And Paul Grether told the council committee, was that Tuesday, that this is common in transit systems, this validate. My personal experience, and I'm going to say that's very limited, is to like the subway in D.C. and Atlanta and the light rail in St. Louis, but I don't remember – but those you have to pay – to physically get on, but I don't remember having to validate anything to ride any of those three systems.
Yeah, it seems like an extra step, but, you know, hey, this is Cincinnati. We can wear them down, people. Let's just keep at it.
And if what's his name's right, it'll take, 10 years, and then we'll fix it.
Yeah, right. Mark Twain. A question about whether that's a real quote or not. Somebody asked me the other day. I don't know, but it's truthy enough where I think I'm going to keep believing it.
Let's talk to Jalen and Clifton. Hi, Jalen.
Hey, how are you?
Good, thanks.
I'm wondering, I've been riding, I've been riding the Metro bus for a while. I used to live in Atlanta and there's the MARTA there and that does really well. As far as basically like a train moving throughout the city and it's been, like Cincinnati has got a lot of suburbs around it. It moves people from the suburbs downtown so they do see the change in Over the Rhine, you know, that kind of thing. How do you feel that it's like affecting us socially? Because the streetcar now is basically going on routes that the bus was already going on. And like you said, like, yeah, if it's only going to be downtown, then it really shouldn't be a thing.
Well, I think that social question is really important because, you know, and I hate to base conclusions based on what I see on social media, but I feel like the first weekend I saw some criticism and maybe legitimate, maybe not, I don't know, but that the people that were riding the streetcar were generally white people versus the people that ride the buses who are generally African American, and there seemed to be a divide there. I think that changed as the weekend went on. I saw more and more diverse set of people going on it. But, you know, at the same time, you know, that on one hand that, you know, that's negative in the sense that, okay, here's a transit system that's going to be viewed as a white people's transit system. At the same time, though, Metro needs to, you know, they need to pass a tax levy in order to expand and to really, really shore up their budget as it exists today. And I think that one of the ways that they can convince people that transit is a worthy thing that they should pay for is through their experiences on this streetcar. So, you know, I think it could be positive in that sense. I'm curious what you think, Pat and Jay. I don't know if that was something you heard as well or what.
I writing it also throughout the week, I definitely noticed that same sort of shift as far as demographics on the streetcar. For me, issues like transit and infrastructure are so much about psychology as much as they are about logistics or kind of more of pen to paper kind of things. And, you know, bringing up the social media commentary is actually, I think, one of the first places you should look. Yeah. That's where conversations happen. And that's where both truth and misconceptions are spread. And it's important to keep an eye on that. But so much of that builds up into a kind of a psychological mindset for the city. And I think we're starting to see a slow shift in kind of the thinking about these kind of projects and how they impact social relationships. But when push comes to shove, connectivity is connectivity, and the more ways to get around means the more places you're going to get and the more kinds of people you're going to see and be able to connect with.
One thing that was cool about – oh, I'm sorry, Jay. Go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just saying to me the whole thing always comes back to funding. I think everyone agrees there needs to be a regional transit system. The problem is there's not a regional funding system to do that, especially when, you know, where we're at, you have three states, multiple counties, and, you know, Metro was funded, what, nearly 60%, 50%, 40%, 60% by an earnings tax from the city of Cincinnati. And if it goes outside of Hamilton County, it's those counties have to pay for it.
One thing that was cool I thought about our streetcar compared to when I ride transit in New York or Chicago or somewhere else, everybody's got their earphones in. They're not talking to each other. On our streetcar, people were talking to each
chatty,
other.
Chatty.
People wanted to, what do you think of it? You know, where are you from? Why, you know, what are you doing down here? So there was a lot of conversations
there's
started.
There's a social impact right there.
It was a huge social impact, and that's great.
Yeah.
And usually for the quiet reserve Midwest, that was a little strange too, because normally, you know, people kind of keep to themselves. But they were, like I said, because that's how I knew that I was riding with people from Texas and Germany, because they were willing to talk.
Yeah.
We will continue our weekly review of local news. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney, and joining us to discuss the stories affecting the tri-state this week are Cincinnati Business Courier staff reporter and columnist Chris Wedrick, WCPO.com, WCPO Insider Transportation and Development reporter Pat LaFleur, and WVXU City Hall reporter Jay Hanselman. You can join us, 513-419-7100, email talk at WVXU.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Jay, you wanted to get something out there?
Yes. We've had a couple of phone calls and a couple of emails, so let me admit it. We made a mistake earlier today. We said that the Reds and Bengals were in town this weekend. The Bengals game is not
in
Cincinnati.
It's in Pittsburgh this weekend.
It's in Pittsburgh. So that was our mistake. We fixed it. But, yes, we do know the Bengals are in Pittsburgh this weekend.
Home opener's not till next weekend.
So,
yeah.
So we
goofed. Another big streetcar weekend, I'm sure.
We goofed. And, yes, we know the Bengals are not in town this weekend.
Well, moving on to something else, Dr. Odell Owens, Chris, Cincinnati's interim health commissioner, he has a new position.
Yeah, he's going to leave the health department, and you know he's been interim director for – I mean they've been looking for a permanent director for about 6 months. I think he's been interim director for roughly that period. He's going to move to the nonprofit organization Interact for Health. This is kind of a big political deal, right, because Odell Owens was the Hamilton County coroner. He was president of Cincinnati State. And then Noble Masiru.
Very good, Jay.
the former director of the health department hired Dr. Owens before Noble left. And so when Noble ended up leaving, it was kind of viewed as maybe by some people, or at least, you know, by some of the constituents that use the health department and by some of the politically astute people in town, it was Dr. Owens' job to have. And he has basically gotten fed up with waiting for them, for the health board to make a decision. And so he has moved on. You know, I think that, I guess I'm surprised by it. I don't know if you are, Jay and Pat, but
to me, the more interesting is the political backstory, even further back than that, part of this goes back to, the relationship between Mayor John Cranley and former Mayor Dwight Tillery, who is the, CEO of the, Center for Closing the Health Gap,
another nonprofit.
And, there were tensions between Mr. Tillery and the former health commissioner, Dr. Masiru, and essentially what I've been told was Dwight was basically promised that his pick would be the next health commissioner, and that was not Dr. Owens. And so there's been a little kerfuffle behind the scenes. And so this now what will be interesting to see is now that Dr. Owens is out of the picture and will not be the permanent health commissioner, who is, and if that person has ties to Dwight Tillery.
Well, there's one finalist for the job, and it is not the person that former Mayor Tillery prefers. Am I recounting that correctly?
I'm thinking that there was Dr. Owens and maybe someone from Florida.
Yeah, somebody from out of state. And we should really be more up to date on these things than we appear to be right now. But the bottom line is the former mayor's pick is not the finalist. So it'll be interesting to see if the health board decides it needs another finalist and should, you know, and who that would be. The other thing is Jason Williams' column in the Inquirer today, his politics column, reported that now that this whole thing has gone aside, that, you know, Mayor Cranley and former Mayor Tillery will, you know, they'll start to get along again.
Kumbaya.
Former mayor, yeah, kumbaya. I don't know if that's Jason's analysis or whether a little birdie whispered that to him or what, but I will be interested to see if Mayor Tillery ends up chairing the mayor's reelection campaign.
Because again, I believe he was the co-chair of his original campaign.
He was, and that's why this has gotten so much attention from political junkies like ourselves.
And meantime, Dr. Odell Owens is now the CEO of Interact for Health. So,
yep. Did he get the job?
They approved him on Wednesday. Okay. And I'm curious, and unless I've missed it, have they named a new interim health commissioner?
Not that I know of.
No, I haven't heard either.
And of course, I'm not sure that he's actually gone yet, though, either. I think there was a period of time there, so it probably is right now still Dr. Owens.
So another topic. City Council approved funding for additional raises for the city's unionized workforce. And this is what – it's putting them on the same level as what the FOP contract that was recently –
Roughly. What the other unions got, or what council told – basically council passed an ordinance that said, hey, City Manager Black, what we would like you to do is give them the same raises that the Fraternal Order of Police got, which was 4% for each of the next 3 years plus a 1% one-time bonus. And so they passed the ordinance, and it was just the strangest thing I've seen at City Hall, really. Basically, ordinances carry the force of law normally, but everybody, including the mayor, the council, and the city manager himself, basically said, well, this is really a suggestion, and this is, you know, we'll try to do this, but, you know, we'll see how it goes. I talked to the city.
Which explains Harry Black's comment, nothing is a given.
Right. That's what he told me after the vote. I said, well, so is it a given that they're going to get these raises? He said, nothing is a given. So basically he put out a memo the other day saying, after I finish negotiating with Cincinnati Organized and Dedicated Employees, it's a union known as CODE, then I'll look at doing memorandums of understanding with the other unions to see if we can get these other raises in there. One of the interesting wrinkles here is that the mayor's office views that ordinance as setting a hard cap on the raises. So basically they're saying every employee in these unions gets 4%, period. They don't get their step raises. There's a minority of employees in each union that are still eligible when they're, you know, promoted up through the ranks. They're eligible to get what's known as a step raise. So if I go from technician 1 to technician 2, and I'm just making that up, you know, I get an extra.
No, it's probably in the city's code someplace.
I get an extra 3 or 4%. The mayor's office says that would be struck out with this ordinance. So,
and Chris is right. It is. I think they're walking a fine line that the mayor and council don't get involved into collective bargaining. So basically what this ordinance does is sets the money aside. Here's where it's going to come from. But then it's up to the manager if he decides to use that money for what
right.
the money that council set aside, whether they use it for raises. My hunch is I'm wondering if these memorandums of understanding with, let's see, it would be fire, AFSCME, and building trades.
And CODE, too.
And CODE. That, you know, perhaps, you know, they'll get the raises, but if there's going to be some other concession along the way that go along with them. And that would be typical contract negotiation. The only thing that's a little different, they're doing it after they already have a contract.
How many city employees are not unionized?
I think it's like, what, 90% are unionized. And that's something else we should point out in the ordinance. Actually, they modified it so that I think there was a motion to also non-represented employees would also be eligible.
So I remember
for these increases.
It was a whole separate ordinance they passed.
Except,
I think Chris Seelbach brought that up on Wednesday.
Except department heads. Right. But as we've learned throughout the last couple of years, there have been some generous raises for department heads. So basically, if all is said and done, at some point, all city employees could get some sort of a raise.
But given what City Manager Black said and some of the other comments you've heard, Chris, how likely is this to happen?
I hate to say this. I really have no idea. Yeah. I don't have a good sense of it. I suspect they will end up with something less than the 4441 that's there. I mean, if you were to add up the whole monetary value of the thing, I don't know. I think some of the employees are going to end up losing out.
City Council also, you had something interesting come up. You have a majority who are supporting a motion that's aiming to eliminate institutional racism in city government. Now, what exactly is this motion calling for? They're calling to put together some kind of a committee that would look at levels of institutional racism, where it's occurring, policies that are causing it, that kind of thing?
Yeah, I mean, it's a motion, so it doesn't carry the force of law. It was something that they passed through a committee and then on the floor of council the other day. You know, there was some admission by certain council members that, you know, this is – you can't just vote to end institutional racism.
Well, I think Chris Seelbach said you have to be careful not to raise people's hopes too much with something like this.
Right, right. I think this was the kind of thing where they wanted to acknowledge publicly that there, you know, that there are issues and that they need to, you know, need to be addressed. And it's kind of part of what the city has been doing the last couple of years to increase minority participation in city contracts. And they had a what's called a Croson study done so that they could implement you know, some preferences, I guess, in contracting. And that was one of the key things that Mayor Cranley ran on. And so that, you know, the fact that they're moving forward on that, you know, it's kind of part and parcel of what this motion was about the other day.
So what's next for the motion, Chris?
You know, I think we'll see some studies, right? We'll see some paperwork and some examinations of what's going on and go from there. You know, I think eliminating institutional racism, that is a huge, huge hill
to climb. It's a big task. You're correct about that.
Yeah. So.
Now, we would be remiss if we didn't bring up the fact that Oktoberfest Cincinnati, we mentioned it earlier in the streetcar segment, but we've got a big event going on in Cincinnati.
Yeah, and considering my last name is German, I should be all things Oktoberfest.
Mine too.
I really don't know that much about it.
When you're about to gross us out with some food numbers.
Right, I'm about to gross you out with some food numbers because I was going to ask you, does anybody know how much food is consumed at this thing?
A lot.
A lot. Well, that's a good way to put it.
Not as much beer, or not as much as the beer, though.
Which is another matter. But 87,000, this is according to the Cincinnati USA Regional Chamber. They went around and they polled vendors to get a feel for this. 87,542 Mets.
Okay.
64,000 sauerkraut balls.
I don't even know how to visualize
these numbers. It's a mountain. 24,640 potato pancakes. This one amazes me. German potato salad. 1,875 pounds. Jay, that's almost...
Oh, my God. That's
a ton. I'm terrible. Thank you. That's almost a ton, isn't it?
I'm just looking forward to this year to being on two streets because those beer lines were awfully long when they were basically the length of the width of Fifth Street. I think that they made a good decision to move it.
And I think the other thing will be interesting to see how soon after Oktoberfest. Clearly, they're going to do a breakdown. How was this location?
Right.
Because before they're going to have to decide if that's where Taste of Cincinnati is going to be in May.
Right. Absolutely.
And I do get criticized. I always say Hanselman. If I'm being German, technically it's Hansel.
Hanselman.
But if you say Hanselman, people tend to have a better chance of spelling it.
Well, Jay, Chris, and Pat, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thanks for having
me. Thank you.
Cincinnati Business Courier staff reporter and columnist Chris Wederich, WCPO.com, WCPO Insider Transportation and Development reporter Pat LaFleur, and WVXU City Hall reporter Jay Hanselman. Okay. Did I get it right that time? Okay. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition. Archives of our programs are available at WVXU.org. The producer for today's show was Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer was Belinda Kai. Dave Shermer was the technical director. William White composed the Cincinnati Edition theme music. I'm Mark Haney. Show up to 75% of people with cancer experience cognitive problems during treatment. On the next Cincinnati Edition, we'll discuss the relationship between cancer therapy and an individual's memory and ability to think clearly. We'll also talk about the role Ohio voters could play in the presidential election. And in focus on technology, Cincinnati soccer players are the latest test group for an anti-concussion device. That's Cincinnati Edition, Monday afternoon at 1 on 91.7 WVXU.